From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Wednesday edition of Washington Watch. Coming up, last Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court sidestepped a major challenge to the present jurisprudence on abortion. The challenge was from a 2016 law crafted by the state of Alabama that prohibited dismemberment abortions. In just a moment, I'll talk with Alabama's Attorney General Steve Marshall. And while the children might be on summer break, those who are helping indoctrinate them are not. This week, the National Education Association is holding the NEA Pride Fest in Houston, complete with drag queens. Meg Kilgana, the Education Research Associate for the Family Research Council, is here with more a little later. And as the 2020 presidential election heats up, we're seeing a recycling of arguments attempting to suppress evangelical participation. We'll talk about it with David Clausen, Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview here at the Family Research Council. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you miss anything on your way home, it'll all be archived later right there at TonyPerkins.com. Share it with your friends. Also, be sure, if you have not yet downloaded the Stand Firm app, do so. Right there on your smartphone. You can make it smarter. Download the app. Go to the App Store, Stand Firm app. We will send you action items when necessary so that you can be a participant in defending this republic of ours. All right, as I mentioned, last Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court sidestepped a major new challenge to abortion by declining to hear Alabama's bid to revive a Republican-backed state law that would have banned dismemberment abortions. Those are those abortions which occur after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Now, the justices left in place a lower court ruling that struck down the 2016 law, which would have criminalized a method called dilation and evacuation. That is the most common type of abortion performed during the second trimester of pregnancy. Now, to be clear, the pro-life law in question is different than an even more protective Alabama measure signed by Governor Kay Ivey in May. The new law also faces a legal challenge, and that would ban nearly all abortions in the state. As we see, states across the country are working diligently to protect the sanctity of human life. I think it's about time. States are pushing back. Here to give us analysis on the outcome of the Supreme Court decision and where this may lead, the Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. General Marshall, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Well, appreciate you joining us. Before we get into the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court said, just explain for our listeners what the 2016 law, the dismemberment ban, actually did.
Well, generally, this law was specific really to less than 10% of the abortions that currently take place in Alabama, which is going to occur during the second trimester, a procedure that commonly referred to dismemberment abortion, one of the most grotesque and horrific medical procedures that you can describe, where basically the doctor to perform the abortion removes and dismembers limbs from that unborn child in order to perform the abortion. And so Alabama felt like, in a very specific area, that even if you accept the constitutional jurisprudence that has come through Roe and Casey, that this was an appropriate action for Alabama in protecting an unborn child. And unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed.
Not everyone on the Supreme Court tended to disagree, because even comments, I should say, from Justice Clarence Thomas in an opinion that he wrote, he said that the notion that anything in the Constitution prevents states from passing laws prohibiting the dismembering of a living child is implausible. So I think you certainly have those that understand the right of the state to protect the unborn and protect generally the overall welfare of the state. In fact, even under Casey, the states are given a lot of latitude in what they can do.
They are. You know, we've seen the partial birth abortion ban be upheld, and we felt like this was a similar argument. All your listeners should be very prayerful and thankful for Justice Thomas, who I think gets not only the fact that states should be the ultimate arbiter here. But you know, one of the things he wrote in this concurrence, although he didn't vote to allow this case to be heard, what he showed through that writing was, I think he specifically said that this was a stark reminder that our abortion jurisprudence has spiraled out of control. And if you look at even liberal commentators, they will acknowledge that Roe versus Wade is an aberration of our constitutional jurisprudence, that the court went out of its way to define a right that just simply doesn't exist. And so I think the hope was through this case that we had the ability to discreetly talk about the right of the state to be able to protect the unborn. And in fact, the 11th Circuit case that, although ruled against us, acknowledged in multiple areas the state's rights to protect the unborn in this area. The reality is that despite putting factual information through recognized experts, that there were other mechanisms in which a doctor could perform a second trimester abortion that was available separate and apart from dismemberment abortion. They still felt that under the Casey standard that this was an undue burden on a woman's right to seek that that abortion. And again, what we hope is that through the efforts of Alabama or other states, as you described earlier, that squarely the court will take on, again, what they have improperly done, as Justice Scalia recognized many years ago, that the Supreme Court has become the ultimate umpire in the area of abortion, and that's not their role.
And I think you are absolutely right. I think it would appear, and some court watchers suggest this based upon Thomas's comments, not only in this case, but in a previous case out of Indiana, in which it sounds like the court may not be ready. This may not be the ideal case, or the cases so far have not been the ideal cases to go for a direct challenge to the presiding jurisprudence. But it sounds like the court is getting closer. And I think this, laws like this from Alabama, Indiana, Louisiana, Texas are moving us closer to that point where the court is going to have to face this issue of abortion in this monster that they have created square on.
Yeah, I think monster they've created is absolutely the right term. And I do think for those that are watching this issue, the Louisiana case probably is the one that creates the best vehicle, at least as it relates to procedural posture and the facts that are there. We've obviously seen some language from justices already in the initial decision that was made there, that there's some willingness to consider this case specifically once the district court has ruled on all the facts. And I do think that that creates an opportunity, as well as others that will be in the pipeline, including Alabama's, to really look at this issue discreetly. But I think the time has come. I think that we have specifically said that the day of reckoning for Roe is soon, and we look forward to being a part of that in whatever way, whether that's supporting some of our states that are like-minded or being able to be the named plaintiff in whatever case the court considers. But I think there is universal acceptance. And if you look at even the 11th Circuit case here that went up, some very conservative, solid judges, although they felt bound by the precedent of Roe and Casey, stated very simply that this is an aberration, that this is not consistent with how the Supreme Court has interpreted our Constitution historically. And so the time has come to get it right. And what we hope is that we now have cases that will do it, along with a court that is willing to consider the mistake they made many years ago through Roe.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. My guest, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall, talking about a court, U.S. Supreme Court decision, declining to take up Alabama's law decision from a lower court that struck down that 2016 law, which prohibited dismemberment abortions. You mentioned, General, you mentioned Louisiana's law. Jeff Landry is a friend of mine. We've discussed the case that Louisiana has in the pipeline, and I think optimistic it could be a case that the court takes. But I think all of these cases that are bubbling up from the states, as you pointed out, whether or not Alabama is the key case that they take or just a part of the process, all of these states that are passing these laws, even though some of them may be struck down, they all play a part in communicating to the Supreme Court that the American public is not satisfied with what they've imposed upon the nation.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you look at Alabama, for example, last year we adopted an amendment to our Constitution where we acknowledged our right to protect the unborn. That was constitutionally an important element of our state, and it's part of our DNA. And I do think that you've seen over the course of the last several months many of our state legislators act in this area in a way that we've not seen. And number one, that's refreshing, because I think, again, it's an acknowledgement of the work that you and many others have done for so long in being able to speak on behalf of the unborn. But also it's a reflection of the people of those states and their beliefs that the state has a vested interest in being able to protect those precious children. And so I think that should send a message, and I think that's clearly part of the national debate. But it is, again, partly originated as a result of the decision made in Roe many years ago, when I think Justice Scalia talked about in a later concurrence that we didn't see this level of debate prior to Roe, that that was really what was the igniter of this discussion nationally, when we have historically accepted the fact that states had the opportunity to be able to act in this area. And so we need to fix that wrong. I do think that the efforts of many states over the last several months have sent a clear message to the court. And what we do know is that Justice Thomas has acknowledged, along with others, that it's time for the court to consider it. You've got multiple federal judges at both the appellate level and the district court level that have acknowledged it is time for the court to take this issue up, and once and for all for us to be able to deal with this issue and, again, to right the wrong that was done that hurt the unborn children of this country.
Well, General Marshall, I commend you for your efforts in defending the law. I know, it's got to be disappointing when the court does not take this case and you're not able to see it all the way through. But you do know you're a part of this process, and grateful for the legislators in Alabama, because so often, you know, as a former legislator, I heard this all the time when I did some kind of new legislation, one of the first abortion clinic regulation acts I did in the late 90s. People say, well, you know, that's not the best way to go after this, and you got to wait for the perfect time. I don't think it's ever the wrong time to do the right thing. And pressing this issue forward is driving the national conversation, which I do believe, as you point out, will ultimately bring justice for the unborn.
Absolutely. And again, we're grateful for the efforts of soldiers like you for many years. And it is, you know, one of the privileges of being Attorney General is to be that voice for those who can't be heard. And what better voice can be for an advocate like me than on behalf of the unborn. And so we'll continue that fight. We, again, have multiple cases that are pending that have this issue in play. And, again, we'll look forward to working with colleagues like Jeff Landry and others to make sure that we can press this issue forward.
All right. We'll be watching and cheering you on as you continue to fight for the unborn.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
All right. General Steve Marshall from Alabama, the attorney general there. Supreme Court deciding not to take their case last week, leaving a lower court ruling in place that struck down their dismemberment abortion ban. But they're not giving up. They're going to continue to fight for the unborn. And you know what? This should be a signal to states across the nation. You know, don't wait for the perfect moment that some of these legal experts say, well, the court's not there yet. Hey, overwhelm the court. Stand up for what you know to be right and to be true. And I'm grateful for lawmakers, elected officials, who will do so on this issue of life and religious liberty and other issues. It's refreshing. It's encouraging. We need them on the school boards, too, by the way. Some of you need to be candidates for school boards. We're going to be talking about what the National Education Association is doing in Houston this week, their Pride Fest. That's next with Meg Kilgannon. Don't go away.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGB activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. If you miss anything on your way home tonight, you can catch it all later at tonyperkins.com. Everything's archived right there. All right, the National Education Association, NEA, is not only the nation's largest union for teachers with approximately 2.7 million members, it's also, well, it's one of the most liberal, promoting all types of, well, stuff that, quite frankly, parents don't agree with. This week, children are enjoying summer vacation, the NEA is hard at work organizing their latest push of, their liberal agenda to indoctrinate your children at their annual conference in Houston, Texas. It's their Pride Week, equipped with everything needed to advance the liberal agenda, including drag queens. Joining me now to talk about this, Meg Kilgannon, the Education Research Associate for the Family Research Council. Meg, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's always great to be with you, Tony.
Why is it that those that want to indoctrinate our children never take a break?
They really never rest, do they? That's why we have to be steadfast and to protect our kids and to instill our values in our children at every opportunity. The NEA convention this year coincides with the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall protest in New York City, and they feel that they must celebrate this. And they're going to have a drag show in a park in Texas, right across from the Houston Convention Center, later today, actually.
I mean, they have Rise Up for Love, Day of Action. It is commemorating, as you pointed out, the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. And, you know, look, it's built as a conference on racial and social justice. There's no way you can tell me that this will not filter into the classroom. I mean, these are teachers. These are educational leaders from across the country coming together for the largest union. this is going to find its way into the classroom.
Right. Well, you know, the defenders of this kind of thing will say, you know, it's a professional association conference. They're all adults there, and they can enjoy adult entertainment if they want to. And I would say, okay, that's true, except we have all these drag queen story hours going on across the country in public libraries. And there's a real effort to normalize drag in particular. There's another show later in the night that is that's billed as a drag fest for drag kings and queens, where they're going to be coming and entertaining the group. So, yeah, I think it very well could make its way into the classroom. I mean, when I was in high school in the 80s, when the boys basketball team was practicing for the games, one of them wanted to play that song from the Jay Giles Band, Centerfold. And when the coaches heard what the song's words were, of course, all the boys got in trouble for putting that on the playlist, and it wasn't allowed to be played. But I feel like today the situation is much different. There's a less of an attitude of protecting kids and more of an attitude of celebrating everybody's identity.
Well,
that's not necessarily safe for children.
Right, exactly. I mean, when you look at the agenda increasingly of the National Education Association, I mean, they are pushing every leftist idea. Do most public school teachers agree with or even know about the leftist worldview of the NEA?
I think most public school teachers are trying very hard to do the best job they can under in a lot of times what are very difficult circumstances. So I think that many teachers are not aware of this agenda. And if they are confronted with it, they have enough other work to do to ignore it, because, you know, it's a difficult and thorny issue to engage. And I think that's why, as parents, we need to make sure that we're letting the school know what our views are and what we, you know, that we expect a safe and a tolerant environment for our children who are raised in homes with a Christian value or any faith value, that we have a right for our children to go unmolested at school just as much as anyone else does.
Right.
And,
that requires parents to actually know what's going on, to be involved,
yes,
in what's going on. And increasingly, you know, I think it's come to a point where, you know, just on the sidelines talking about it, even speaking into it, has limited effect, because you've got these alliances on the left. I think you've got to have, mm-hmm, we've got to have these alliances on the right. But also, I think we've got to have Christian parents in the decision-making positions, school boards, school administrators, deciding
Absolutely.
What comes in and what does not come in.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. There's never been a better time for you to run for school board in your area. Our judgments are very much needed as a counterpoint. So often this agenda from the left goes completely unchallenged at the local level. And this is exacerbated with the decline of local newspapers, right? And local
right.
media.
Right.
Everything seems to have a national focus now. And so these state and local issues and what's going on in your city or town or county, it's hard to find out, you know, and parents are busy.
Right.
We're working and raising our kids. It's hard for us to find out what's going on, but you need to make it a point to find out what's going on.
Yeah, you can no longer just assume that things are okay. You just have to basically assume things are not okay and be informed as to what is happening. You just you cannot accept that things are okay. I mean, again, you just can't believe things are okay. Meg, we're up against a break. We're going to come back. I want you to stick around, because I want to talk about alternatives for Christian teachers that are out there, what they might do to link up with other like-minded teachers. But folks, again, as parents, you got to take responsibility for this. You got to be involved. You got to be informed and step out and make a difference in your community. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right after this.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Listening to Washington Watch, I'm Tony Perkins, the website TonyPerkins.com. Be sure and download the Stand Firm app so that you know what's going on and what you can do about it. Go to the App Store and look up the Stand Firm app, or go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links over. All right, talking about the National Education Association in Houston this week, celebrating Pride. They have, it's fully equipped. They've got their own drag queen show, drag kings and queens, just to be specific. This is the largest union for teachers. They heavily influence education. Talking about this with Meg Kilgannon, Education Research Associate here at the Family Research Council. Meg, as we were talking about earlier, most teachers really don't know what the NEA is doing, quite frankly don't care. They're focused on the classroom, although they don't realize right. just how much of an influence this organization has on the on what happens in the classrooms, what happens in the schools, because these are activists who are pushing an agenda. What alternatives are there for conservative or Christian teachers out there where they could link up with like-minded teachers?
Well, there is a Christian Teachers Association, and it is my sincere hope that in light of the Janus decision that makes it illegal to require the joining of unions as a condition of your work. I hope that more associations, local associations for teachers will pop up, because here's the problem. When the gym teacher in Pasco County, Florida, heard about the new transgender policies in his school and asked, so does this mean I'm going to have to supervise a girl in the boys' shower? And he was told that, yes, in fact, these policies meant that a girl who identifies as a boy can access those showers. He refused to do that. And it wasn't the NEA who came to his defense, right? It it was Liberty Counsel, a Christian legal organization based in Florida and Virginia. So as these sorts of issues, if a teacher, if a Christian teacher has a conscious objection to teaching, let's say, LGBT sex ed or anything else, it's not going to be the NEA that defends you in a legal action. Your union rep is not going to have your back on that because right. they're with the agenda, right? They're with the leftist agenda. So I think as more cases like that crop up, there was a case in Virginia of the school teacher, Richard Blaming, who was fired for using the wrong pronoun for a transgender student. He lost his job. He has a wife and four kids to support. And this was in Virginia. So as more cases like that pop up, crop up, and the NEA doesn't defend those teachers, but those teachers have to find their own counsel in spite of having been a good standing member of the union in some cases for many years, hopefully they will create more of a demand for an alternative.
Well, we're seeing more and more.
There is the Christian Teachers Association. That is a viable alternative right now.
We're seeing more and more of these associations, professional associations, and I use that term loosely, professional, are being taken over by these leftists, in particular those pushing the LGBTQ agenda, whether it be in the medical associations, whether it be educational associations. They are clearly pushing an agenda. And this is something we've talked about before on the program with you, Meg, but parents need to be aware. And what are some of the things they should be looking for come this fall as school is back in session and they put their kids on the bus, you know, sending them there to what have become quite, in some places, nothing more than indoctrination centers?
Right. The most important thing you can do always as a parent is communicate with your child. Listen to them. Listen to what they say when they come home. Ask them probing questions. And monitor the if they're in upper grades, look at the syllabus for the class. If they're in lower grades, as often as you can to volunteer in the school, get in there and volunteer and see what's going on. Meet your teachers, meet your child's teachers, go to events. You know, for Christians, I found this challenge as, you know, we're a practicing Catholic family, and a lot of our social life centered around activities at our church, for activities for the kids at the church and what have you. And I think that's true for a lot of people of faith, is that we don't see the school as that central place in our community. For us, it's our church. But for people who don't go to church, that central place is the local school. And a lot of social activity and community activity happens at school. So if you want to be aware of what's going on and you want to have an impact on that community, you need to make a conscious effort to attend everything you can at your local school. Because there are plenty of people who unfortunately don't have the same kind of community that we as Christians enjoy in our churches.
Right.
And I would love to see churches, for example, send a representative to school board meetings and just keep an eye on what's going on and report back to the congregation.
Good idea. It'd be a good thing to do for our culture, our community impact teams, to have a representative from the churches go to those public meetings. Meg, thanks so much for joining us. Always great to hear from you, and appreciate you keeping us posted on what's happening in the classrooms across America.
Thank you so much for everything that Family Research Council does for families.
All right. Thanks so much, Meg. Meg Kilgannon. To find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. All right. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us. The website is tonyperkins.com. Again, let me remind you to get the Stand Firm app. Our republic is not made for spectators. It's made for participants, and we want to help you be a participant in defending this republic. Go to the App Store and download the Stand Firm app. All right. Before I get to my next guest, I just want to wrap up our conversation or the thoughts I had from our conversation with Meg. You know, parents, I talk about this a lot about education. I'm number one. Let me say this. I'm grateful for Christian young people who are called into the field of education and who will go into our public schools and be teachers and teach with great professionalism and with excellence and with love and compassion, and show children through their lives a better way. In fact, in this increasingly secular culture, that may be the only place that children encounter a authentic believer. And so I certainly encourage that. I see it as a mission field, just as I do government. But parents, you should prayerfully consider where you have your children. Whether or not they are in the public schools, whether that's where they should be. And I know some would say, well, I don't have any options. I can't afford private school. I get that. We with five kids, we couldn't either. But there's the homeschool option. And with today, it is so much different. With more and more people that are homeschooling, there are so many options available for homeschooling. Curriculum that's available online, computer-based curriculum. There are co-ops in communities all across the country where you can join with others. Anyway, just prayerfully consider it. But at a minimum, parents, have conversations daily with your children. I know I look at the statistics. Not many families actually have dinner together at night, sitting around the table, having conversation like they used to. If your children are in public schools, you need to have a daily debrief with them. And dinner is a great time to do it. Sit around the table. Hey, what'd you learn today? What'd the teacher say? And it's good to begin these conversations early with your children so that they are, you know, they feel free to communicate with you. And you want to tell them, look, you can tell me whatever you want to tell me. I've listened. And you know, try not to respond in a, you know, I know some of the stuff you hear is going to make you angry, but don't let your children feel like that is directed at them. You want to want them to feel like they can share with you anything and everything that they're hearing and seeing in school. And then walk them through, this is how you develop a biblical worldview. You kind of walk them through this using Scripture and help them understand right from wrong, truth from a lie. Anyway, so important, so important. Everything you invest in your children when they're young, when they're small, when they're heading off to school, pays tremendous dividends in the long run. Trust me. Trust me, I know. All right, speaking of biblical worldview, I want to talk about this now. We're seeing with the approaching of the 2020 election, kind of a recycling of a lot of those arguments that were made back in the 2016 election, some of them coming from the category of what they called the Never Trumpers, you know, these kind of quote-unquote Christian leaders who were criticizing evangelicals being involved and of course, being involved in supporting Donald Trump in the general election. Of course, they were given, and once again, they are being given again platforms by the left, because I think this is designed to suppress the evangelical turnout, which is what the left will need to succeed in electing someone like Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden or, you know, pick any number of them. But I want to take a moment and talk through some of these arguments that are being made about Christians voting for or supporting a candidate like Donald Trump. Well, joining now to discuss this is David Clawson. He's the Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview here at the Family Research Council. And I'm so glad David has joined our team, because what we are going to be doing is just helping Christians sync their public walk with their private faith so that we there's this consistency, there's this integrity that takes place. David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you for having me back on Washington Watch, Tony. It's good to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit. There's been a number of pieces that are being, we're starting to see pop back up. There was one recently I just saw. And it's the same, as I said, recycled arguments about why Christians, should sit out this election, or they should pursue a third party candidate. But whatever, whatever they do, they should not vote for Donald Trump. And let me just say this before we get into this conversation. Washington Watch or the Family Research Council does not endorse candidates nor get involved directly in elections. We're talking about the decision making here of using biblical principles to guide our political or public engagement. So we're talking about principles here. So you could insert any name. All right. You can take any name. But in this case, we're using the specific names of Donald Trump. So with that, David, what are some of the arguments that we're seeing pop back up?
Well, you're right, Tony. And really, I think the word you just used is kind of these recycled arguments. And really, since 2016, I've listened carefully to this type of argument. The argument is essentially this, that Donald Trump's moral life makes him unfit for the presidency. Now, when they refer to his moral life, what they're referring to is his decades as a New York celebrity, or maybe more specifically, the inappropriate comments that were made on a hot mic back in 2005. Now, no Christian I know is condoning decisions Donald Trump made as a New York socialite in the 1980s or 1990s. No Christian I know is saying those 2005 comments are, you know, morally neutral or morally praiseworthy. Of course not. Then-candidate Trump himself even apologized for those comments and promised to learn and to grow. And as Christians, I just want to say, as Christians who've received forgiveness and experienced God's grace in our own lives, I think we should give him the benefit of the doubt that he's learned from that whole ordeal. And we should also be grateful that there's been no scandal or of personal morality since President Trump took office. And it does appear the Trump family, including the First Lady, have set a positive example for families during their time in the White House. But the broader point is this.
Hey, let me just jump in there for a minute, David, because I think it's a really important point, because a lot of these that are bringing up that issue. And by the way, I have been very clear. You know, there's no one that is condoning that behavior. In fact, most evangelicals like myself were not supporting Donald Trump when there were other options available in the primary. It was only when it came down to a choice between Hillary Clinton, who embraced policies that were antithetical to Christian beliefs, juxtaposed to a candidate in Donald Trump who actually had embraced those policies, which were more in line with biblical principles. But that said, we see that people are now saying, well, you know, conservatives, Christians, evangelicals were appalled at Bill Clinton. And they made, in fact, I saw one make comment about the Southern Baptists releasing a statement about public morality back during Clinton's administration. But they fail to mention one specific thing, and you brought this up in your comment. I want to just expound upon it for a moment. And that is, Bill Clinton had been engaged in this activity in the White House. If we remember, for those that remember Monica Lewinsky, that was activity that occurred while he was president in the Oval Office. As you said, Donald Trump, and this is what I have reiterated time and time again, that evangelical support of Donald Trump is conditional upon A, him keeping his promises, and B, that he walks the straight and narrow from the point that we supported him forward. And to our knowledge, and to all, even the media, if they knew something, I'm sure they would say it. That's what he's done since he's been president.
Yeah, none of us are arguing that Donald Trump's a paragon of moral virtue. Not saying that, but we are grateful that since he was sworn in as president, from all appearances, it's him and the First Lady and their family have provided a good example for what it looks like to be a family. So we're grateful for that.
Now, one of the things that I saw someone recently say, one of these kind of never Trumper individuals, that evangelicals are reacting out of fear and not faith. Talk to that.
I think I've seen articles that have made that argument as well, Tony. And I think you're right. These commentators are arguing that evangelicals are compromising morally by expressing support for the current administration. I think I even heard one evangelical say that support for the administration is degrading the church's witness. And it's the argument, I think explicitly the argument they made was that evangelicals are seeking secular salvation. Now, my response to that is simply, that's not true. For the evangelical leaders, the pastors, the faithful Christians that I know, they're not seeking a secular salvation. You know, the message of the gospel has not changed. The message of the gospel is that sinful people can be reconciled to a holy and righteous God through repentance and faith in Jesus Christ. That's the gospel. No one I know is arguing figuratively or literally for this kind of political salvation.
Well, what those that are advancing that particular argument are only facilitating those who think the social gospel will save us.
No, exactly.
On the other side, what we see in the policies that we have seen from this president and the judges in particular that he's appointed to the Supreme Court, what we actually see and what we desire as evangelicals in this country is this: we want to put feet to our prayer so that we can live peaceably in this country. But the policies that we see enacted by our government, whether it be a state government, local government, or the federal government, in many ways cast the die for the environment in which we will have the right to practice our faith or not have the right to practice our faith. And that's not just the freedom of worship. We want to have laws that allow us to freely live out our faith so that we can share our faith and evangelize. And this is what really, really gets me, David, by some of these other individuals who say, well, the church prospers under persecution. The church generally has faced persecution when it's advancing. In the early days of the church, the reason there was persecution is because it was changing the culture, not when it was in retreat. And if we're stepping back in retreat, the persecution is coming because we are not being true to the gospel of going forth, making disciples, and literally changing the world for the good for everyone.
Oh, absolutely. And just going back to the point you're making, this isn't an issue of fear versus faith. I think that's just a false dichotomy. It's an issue between making wise and informed decisions versus making foolish decisions. And in the context of elections, in the context of campaigns, the party platforms also have to be a part of this conversation. And when you look, and I know our listeners are aware that every 4 years, both the Republicans and the Democrats get together at their convention, they put together a platform that essentially sets forth, that articulates their governing philosophy, and here's what we're going to do if you elect us. And if you look at the most recent platforms from 2016, in my view, there's a stark difference between where the major parties stand on the clear moral issues. And Tony, I wish that wasn't the case. I wish both political parties believed in the sanctity of life. I wish both parties opposed late term, or what we've been calling birthday abortions. I wish both parties didn't want to impose an agenda of unrestricted LGBT rights on the entire country, but one of them does. And as we're getting ready to approach the 2020 election, which is already upon us, these are things that we need to carefully think through. And I've heard you say this before. This is what Christians, it requires us to use discernment, to prayer, digging into the issues. And these are the things that we need to be doing as we approach the election.
Yeah, and that's a good point for me, a good place for me to say this. I've never been a big party person. Now, I see the parties as vehicles to carry a message. And we live in a society in which you basically have a two-party system. I know you've had third-party attempts to run for president, and they never work because we're essentially set as a two-party system of government. And as Christians, I think we should seek to influence those parties. Now, we have seen in the last three decades, it's been happening for a while, but it has come to a place where there is such a sharp contrast between the two that it is, there's no question as to where the parties stand. I think we should, our allegiance is not to a party, but if we can use that party to advance constitutional principles, biblical principles, then we should. And I think that's the influence that many have had with the Republican Party. And as you point out, those platforms, they matter because 3/4 of the time, 75% of the time, history shows the Democrats stick to their party platform, and almost 80% of the time the Republicans stick to theirs. So these things matter.
Oh, absolutely. And just on that point again about the platforms, I found it just incredible. I think it was last week you had Democrats tripping over themselves in South Carolina at the Planned Parenthood Forum, every single one of them pledging their support to Planned Parenthood and overturning the Hyde Amendment, which is something Barack Obama didn't even do when he ran for re-election in 2012.
It is a new Democratic Party. David, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us, and welcome again to the Family Research Council. Glad to have you on board.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, folks, we're out of time, but there'll be next time. Until then, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, you've done everything you could do when you prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. By all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.